The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this April 22nd, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on that later in the hour. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It's my pleasure to welcome debut novelists Naomi Munavera and Aline Ohanessian to the show this morning. Naomi is with me now, and Aline will join me for the second half of the show. Naomi was born in Colombo, Sri Lanka. At the age of three, she immigrated with her family to Nigeria. In 1984, a military coup necessitated a third migration, and her family settled in Southern California. She holds a bachelor's degree in literature from right here at UCI and a master's degree in South Asian literature from the University of California, Riverside. In 2001, she abandoned her PhD studies at Riverside after it became impossible for her to ignore that her heart belonged not to academia, but to the novel. She moved to the Bay Area and taught at a community college, tutored students, and wrote a novel. Island of a Thousand Mirrors was initially published in South Asia in 2012. It went on to be nominated for many of the subcontinent's major literary prizes and won the Commonwealth Regional Prize for Asia. The novel was released in America by St. Martin's Press last year. Naomi is an alumni of VONA Voices Workshop and the Squaw Valley Community of Writers. She lives in Oakland and is currently at work on her second novel. Naomi, welcome.
Thank you, Marie. So great to be here.
It's great to see you. I got a great chance to see you at Literary Orange this year and was blown away. And so it's a huge pleasure to have you on. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm going to give you a chance to talk about Island of a Thousand Mirrors. Kind of take us into that world, the content of the novel, and what inspired it.
So this book is about the civil war in Sri Lanka, and I'm sure your listeners know this. Sri Lanka is a small island off the coast of India. It's about 22 miles off the southern coast. It's an independent nation, and from 83 to 2009, we had this very long and brutal civil war between two ethnicities, the Sinhalese, which are about 73%, and the Tamils, represented by the Tamil Tigers, which was the population was represented about 13% Tamil. And this war went on, as I said, for 26 years, and the death toll was 80,000 to 100,000 people. And I grew up mostly outside Sri Lanka, but for about a month of every year, we would go back to Sri Lanka. And so I had a sense of what was happening, and also this war was happening sort of outside the boundaries of my life, and that happening to people that I love. My dad's whole family was back there. And so when I started writing, I was really interested in trying to think about what this experience had meant to both sides and humanize both sides. And because I was outside Sri Lanka, I wasn't politicized in the same way that I would have been if I lived in Sri Lanka. So with this book, it took a very long time and took a long time to publish. I started writing in 2001, and it wasn't published till 2012, and then actually came out in America in 2014. It's been doing really well. It was reviewed by The Times and Publishers Weekly and lots of really good stuff, but, you know, a very long journey, as any novelist knows.
Yeah, I was going to get into this a little later, but maybe we'll jump into it now. The journey to publication is really interesting because, as you said, it took you 5 years to write, and then it took you 5 years to shop, and then you put it away in a drawer. And then I hear this wonderful story that Facebook, of all great social media, you reconnected with somebody, with an old friend who had publishing connections, and that's what got it out of the drawer and onto bookshelves.
Right, right. So I abandoned my PhD in 2001, much to the chagrin of my family, and decided to write a novel. And so I was writing till about 2007, and then found an agent, and he loved it, but he said, you know, this book isn't finished. And the problem was that the war wasn't finished in Sri Lanka, so I didn't know what my characters would do. So I sort of had to sit on it, and, you know, like when I was growing up, and sort of through my adolescence, the feeling was this war would never end. We thought we would live with it for the rest of our lives. So I didn't know how to sort of end the book or anything until 2009 when the war actually ended and I was able to finish it. And then the American agent sent it out. All the publishing houses said no. It was just like absolute no across the board, every house he sent it to. And then I thought, okay, well, you know, everybody has a first novel. You just start the second one. So I was writing another one. And then in 2011, I reconnected with a Sri Lankan friend of mine who we grew up together in Nigeria. And she had moved back to Sri Lanka when I moved to America. And she said, you know, well, I have these friends that run a tiny publishing house in Sri Lanka. It's a husband and wife team. They run it out of their garage. They might be interested. So I sent it to them, and they loved it, which was great for me because, you know, as a writer, you have so much doubt, and especially as a writer trying to write about this country that I didn't grow up in and this war I didn't go through, it was just tremendous amounts of doubt. And they wanted it. They published 1,000 copies and, you know, tiny, tiny start. No money was involved. And then India got interested. And when it came out in India, then it was up for a bunch of different prizes, like the DSC, which Jhumpa Lahiri won the next year. And then America was interested. So it was picked up by St. Martin's Press, and they gave me a 2-book deal. So I'm finishing my second novel, which will actually be out in spring of next year.
That's so great. I know. I never know what to make of this, that you have these amazing novels and lyrical prose, amazing, compelling plot, great characters. Mm-hmm. And what? Like, why do some make it and some don't? I just, you know, I don't know what to make of
it. It's such an absolute mystery. I mean, for the writers out there who are pounding their heads and don't know what's going on, I mean, the only thing I can say is just dogged determination and patience and perseverance and all that stuff. And just like, I feel like if you don't give up, if you're like insane about not giving up, like something will happen. The writers that I've been sort of in league with for years and years, like at some point things start happening, and that might be small, that might be big, but it's just a matter of like not giving up, like not going to law school and not trying to make any money and just, you know, being at it for a very, very long time. So, and luck. I mean, it's like a bizarre, bizarre thing. Like, it is difficult to know what will hit and what won't. You know, like,
right.
You know, and then there are some books that are like, wow, that's in print. Okay. And this other brilliant thing that your friend wrote, there's absolutely no interest. So it's a very strange thing to do.
The lovely thing that came out of this, I think, is that your love is clearly of writing and not of, publication is important, but it doesn't seem like the most important thing to you, that you persevered and were going to, you know, start on a second novel. And so passion for the word is really clear on the page and really, you know, I think the results bear out over time. So
thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you know, you do get depressed, of course, like that's just a sort of occupational hazard of this job. And then you have to think, well, would I be writing if I wasn't published? And that's like a really important question. And if the answer is yes, then you do, you know, then you keep writing it because you sort of almost don't have a choice.
Right.
So it's not, I mean, publication is fantastic and wonderful and we all want it, but it's not like, I mean, if you weren't published, would you still write? I think that's like the big question.
That's the big question. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I want to talk a little about voice. I'm becoming more convinced that it's very difficult to write anything, fiction or nonfiction, without the voice really clearly set. And, you know, maybe you don't know what's going to happen or you don't exactly know who the people are or all their contours, but somebody has to be speaking to you. And this voice is, or this book is told from a couple of different points of view. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about voice, about hearing these people talk, how that came about, if you felt that was essential before you could really get to know these people and,
I mean, you're absolutely right. I think voice is incredibly important because characters are incredibly important and you have to know them so well and they, you know, at some point have to reveal themselves to you. So when I first started writing this book, it was a completely different book. There were these like roommates in San Francisco walking around and talking and none of that made it into the book. But then at some point, Yasodhara, who is my Sinhala character, she started talking and she was very loud and clear, and her experience is relatively similar to mine. She's Sinhalese. She she stays in Sri Lanka, unlike me, and, you know, she's seen the war in Colombo. And so she was, her voice came strong, clear, very, somewhat easily. And then sort of in the middle of the book, the voice of the other character, Saraswati, who is the young Tamil girl living in the north of the country and going through active warfare, started coming. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, this is not a voice I want to take on because it's so different from my own experience. She's Tamil. She's from the north of the country, a part of the country that actually was closed off for the majority of that war. So it would have been easier for me to travel pretty much anywhere else in the world except to the north of Sri Lanka because it was closed off and there was active warfare. So I couldn't even, like, go there and do research. So it was based on a lot of reading and trying to understand what her life was like. And then she just started talking, and I'm like, oh, my God, I can't ignore this because, like, I'm trying to tell the story of this war, and it would be incredibly one-sided if I didn't take on her voice. So I took it on with a lot of trepidation, and she actually is, like, a pretty powerful voice. She's starts talking in the middle of the book, and she takes us, like, right into what the war looks like on the ground, what's happening. Especially I was interested in what's happening to women and women's bodies, like, in the context of war. So, you know, a voice very, very different from my own, and she just started talking, and I've had people say that grew up in that part of the country say, yeah, you got this pretty closely, which is just incredible, and, like, I don't even really understand quite how that happens. But, you know, at some point they just start talking to you. It's a very bizarre process that I don't think we quite understand, but it's imagination, it's memory, and then, you know, it's also somewhat like channeling or something.
Yeah. Thank God it happens, yeah. Right? However it happens, thank God it happens.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yes.
My guest this morning is Naomi Munivera. The book is Island of a Thousand Mirrors. Here's a really ignorant question. English is your not first?
Yes.
First language.
Yeah, because we're a British colony.
Yeah.
We're very colonized. English and Sinhalese is what I can speak.
Because I was wondering, in the context of both this novel and Aline's novel, I was thinking about whether writing in English, you know, like Eskimos have so many words for snow, perhaps English isn't the best language in which to write atrocity. And certainly English speakers have experienced enough warfare. But I was wondering if there were any frustrations or inadequacies in writing in this language, and if Sinhalese would have given you a broader palette, or if you feel that English could adequately translate the experiences of Sri Lanka?
That's such a great question. Well, I'm illiterate in Sinhalese because I lived at three, so I can't read or write. I can speak pretty well. So, you know, English is the language I can write in. It's kind of the only language I can write in. So I feel like it's quite a powerful language for expressing all of that. There are things that people say in Sri Lanka, lots of things that have no translation, and the timbre is quite different. But because I can't read or write, there's no way I could sort of use that stuff. And the book is being translated now into several different languages. It's being translated into Sinhalese and Tamil, which is incredible. And it's also like in it's in Spanish, and it's coming out in French. It's in Australia and English, of course. And then it came out in Dutch, which was so strange to see because, I mean, I can't read Dutch, so even the title looks, like, completely different, which is a very strange experience. But, yeah, so it's out there in different languages. Who knows what it sounds like, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that strikes me is that your language is incredibly lyrical, but your descriptions are based a lot in nature. You know, you have a garden hose that's the weight of an anaconda. You have vegetables that are compared to peacocks. There are all these amazing metaphors and similes that feel like they have a real nature base. And I was thinking that's got to come from living in that land, or, you know, your child memory or your generational memory or something that feels so much, you know, a writer from L.A. was writing this, we just don't have that sort of loamy experience of living in the, you know, nature and vegetables. We don't have this. We don't have this language, even though, you know, obviously we have the language. But we. I don't know. It just struck me as I was reading gorgeous description after gorgeous description where that comes from. It's really great.
Right, right. I mean, Sri Lanka is like a gorgeous, lush, tropical island. So I wanted to capture that. And then the other thing is, like, I'm writing about atrocity and war. So you have to have something to balance that and say, you know, there's joy and beauty and love in the world. There's a couple of love stories in there. So you have to make sure that you're not sort of beating the reader over the head with this just relentless, like, violence. Because then, you know, sort of the violence, like, loses its power. So I made a choice about what things to balance it with. And, you know, as you picked up nature, and then there's lots of food. Lots and lots of food. So just to be like, okay, well, this is the terrible stuff, and then this is all the stuff that makes life worth living and that these characters are really reveling in and enjoying and, like, loving. So you have to have that balance. Like, my new book that I'm editing right now, it's also, like, a very dark subject, and the balance is flowers. So I'm spending a lot of time of thinking about flowers and, like, I just building up those metaphors and similes about flowers and blossoms and all of that.
Do you keep journals or notebooks where you just sort of, you know, jot things down as you know, the weight of the garden hose is like a snake? do these things come organically, or do you kind of write them
down? Yeah, I love this question. Nobody ever asks writers about journals, and they should. I've been journaling since I was 16. My dad gave me this when I was 16 for New Year. He gave me like a day planner, and then that turned into my journal, and then I never stopped. And to this day, I have all of them. Like, the heaviest thing in my possession is my chest cup, three chests full of journals. Like, and then I take them everywhere I go. And yes, I think for a writer, it's incredibly important that you're, like, using that muscle, just talking about your own life. And that, so the way my journals work is, from front to back is me talking about my life or whatever I'm seeing. Back to front is notes about the book.
Oh, clever.
Does that make sense?
I like that.
So, yeah, so, like, at some point they meet up in the middle, and then I'm like, oh, time for a new journal. But tons of notes, and, like, okay, I need to work on this. Like, and then I write questions to myself, like, what is this character doing? Like, do they have a job? What's their job? Like, what color are their eyes? I mean, that's a stupid question. But, you know, just, like, tons of questions, and then I check them off as I answer them.
That is brilliant. And then that would be a very interesting spot where the two meet up.
Like, yes, that. Yes. Of course, it's also, like, what I need to do today is, like, groceries, laundry, you know, that stuff is also in there. So it's really banal. But, you know, like, the writing of the daily life is such an important thing, I think, because it, like, keeps you engaged with the voice, and also, like, you sort of fictionalize your own life. Not fictionalize, you're, like, documenting your own life, but you're doing it in this way that you're working out a lot of stuff, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
Books are obsessions. I think, like, every really good novel is something that the author was completely obsessed with for years and years. So you're working out those obsessions in the book, but then there has to be a similar sort of documenting of the life. Or, I mean, that doesn't have to be, but there is for me. So
right. No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Right.
And then do you keep your research? I assume the research for the book goes in other, is that a journaling sort of exercise as well, or do you keep that in separate documents?
No, it's in there too.
Yeah. Neat.
Yeah. It's like from the back to forward part. Yeah.
You should publish your journals. That'd be great.
Oh, my God. Oh, God, there's so many. I'm also an artist, so they're full of, like, sketches and stuff.
Yeah, I am always interested in the intersection of art and language and, you know, how you communicate story. And that's there are a lot of different ways to tell a story, and art is yet another one. So I think the journals are interesting. I've just started keeping photographs and, you know, cutouts and things in journals. I don't know, that just prompt different parts of your brain, I think, than words do, than language does.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. It's all storytelling, right? Like, I think that some of us are just wired to do that, and we don't have a choice. We have to do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right, exactly. My guest this morning is Naomi Munavira, the book Island of a Thousand Mirrors. So you had touched on writing Atrocity a moment ago, and let's go back to that a little bit and finding the right balance where your descriptions never come across as gratuitous or, you know, prurient or something like that. Communicating enough to the reader, it's such a fine balance, I think. And it's heart-wrenching, and it's probably not all of the, you know, it couldn't be all of the horrors. So tell me a little bit about that balance you talked about with balancing it against beauty, but some of the other techniques that you use to find the right tone for writing Atrocity.
So when I took on this subject, when I was like, oh God, this book is about the Civil War, there has to be a way in which we talk about these terrible things that happened. So I have quite, not tons of scenes, but I have maybe at least like three or four scenes that are like, oh God, okay. For one I can talk about is like the race riots that happened in 1983 in Colombo, and about 3,000 people were killed on the streets. And so I have a character in the midst of that. And I think the really important thing is you have to be really well grounded in your character. So if the character is very real and the reader is feeling empathy with the character and the character is seeing all this terrible stuff, then it's doable through their eyes. So it's not like a textbook or something. It's not removed, mm-hmm. right? So, mm-hmm. yeah, so we sort of follow, like, the instance I'm thinking about is this Aunt Mala, and she's pregnant, mm-hmm. and she's in the car with her husband, and they're sort of going to the hospital, and they realize that they're in the midst of these, like, race riots that happened in 83, and then this terrible violence happens. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it works, I think, is because we like her. We like Mala. We are on the journey with her. So it's just absolutely terrifying that these things are happening to this person that we quite like.
Right.
And so, you know, I think it's just a matter of connecting with the character.
Right.
I'm sorry, that's my cat.
He wants to get out of the
she's
action.
Very literary, so
right.
She's jumping in to answer questions. Also.
Cats often are. I know.
Yes. So I mean, I think it's just, you know, you have to be in the skin of the character, and then you have to feel what the character is feeling, and then your reader will also feel that. You know, it's like a transmission of feeling. I think, like, as writers, our raw material is the feelings of our readers, and we're trying to connect with that.
Right. That's yeah. also probably a good technique for, it would be very easy to lecture the reader on politics or geography or something that they're not, history, that they're not familiar with the bounds of research I know you did for this. Mm-hmm. It would be difficult to translate all of that factual information to the reader without sounding preachy and textbooky. And
exactly.
That's probably another good technique, is to just do it all through your character, your character's eyes, what they're experiencing.
Absolutely, because, you know, actually this book, it's about 260 pages, and the earlier manuscripts were maybe two or three times bigger, and I had a lot of politics in there. I had, like, assassinations of presidents, and I had, like, you know, this happened and that happened, and, you know, at some point it was just like, oh my God, like, who cares? Like, if they want to really know about this stuff, they can go and read a history book, but that's not the project of literature. The project of literature is to make you feel, so then I just started, like, cutting and cutting until it's very bare and quite sparse, and it's very, very connected to what these two characters are going through. I mean, there's still, the early part of the book has quite a few characters. There's extended families and stuff, which I think, like, in a South Asian novel, you just cannot get away from, like, the multi-generations. But, yeah, I mean, you want to make, it's not a history book, it's not a textbook, and that's, like, the beauty of it, right? Like, it's somewhat almost more powerful in that way because you are connected to these people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Before we draw too far down on our time, I wanted to give you a chance to just read a quick passage from it so that our listeners know exactly the sound of this voice.
Great. So I'm going to read a part from very early in the book. And what's happening here is I'm talking about the two sides of this war in terms of their flags. And the other thing to know is this is right after colonization ends, so I'll refer to the British leaving. Behind the retreating Englishman on the new nation's flag is poised a stylized lion. All curving flank and ornate muscle, a long, cruel sword gripped in its front paw. It is the ancient symbol of the Sinhala, who believe they're descended from the lovemaking between an exiled Indian princess and a large jungle cat. A green stripe represents that small and much-tossed Muslim population. An orange stripe represents the larger Tamil minority. But in the decades that are coming, race riots and discrimination will render the orange stripe inadequate. It will be replaced by a new flag. On its face, a snarling tiger, all bared fang and bristling whisker. If the idea of militancy is not conveyed strongly enough, dagger-clawed paws burst forth while crossed rifles rear over the cat's head. A rifle-toting tiger, a sword-gripping lion. This is a war which will be waged between related beasts.
You know why I love that passage, thank you for reading it, is mm-hmm. that it perfectly encapsulates what we were just talking about of communicating politics and history through gorgeous language so that the reader doesn't realize how much they're learning while they're learning it. That's fantastic. I love it.
Thank you. You know, the funny thing about that, so what I'm talking about is the flag of Sri Lanka is it's literally a lion gripping a sword, and then the Tamil tigers took the tiger as their symbol, and their flag is exactly what I described. And so I do book clubs in Sri Lanka. I was just in Sri Lanka doing a book club, and you know, at this book club, someone said, I read that passage, and people said, "Oh my God, we never thought of the fact that our lion flag is like so militant." I'm like, yeah, it's the lion with the sword, guys. You know, but it's just so normalized. Like when you live in a country, you don't really see anymore.
Right.
And that was a really interesting moment because the whole sort of book club was like, wow, yeah, that's a really strong message we've got with our flag.
Right.
No wonder they like had a similarly militant sort of flag.
You know, the interesting thing about that observation, which is an observation I heard you make at Literary Orange, is the importance of distance when you're writing about a
mm-hmm.
place. And you writing this novel from the U.S. obviously produced a much different novel than it would have if you were living there. Maybe this is too big of a question to tackle now, but do you think in future work it's going to remain important to you to be geographically distant from the places you write about?
Oh, that's a great question. And I don't think so. I think because of this particular subject, I mean, the other thing about writing about the war in Sri Lanka would have been safety. You know, there were journalists and writers that disappeared all the time. So, you know, taking on that subject would just have been, like, not safe to do
right.
if I lived in Sri Lanka. So because of that and just how politicized it is, I mean, like, if you go online even today and look at the chat boards about the Sri Lankan Civil War, my God, it's, like psychically dangerous. People are just so, like, angry, as, you know, I understand, but it's very scary. I think I need a distance to write this book. I don't think I need distance to write every book I'm going to write. The second novel that I'm finishing right now, this week, actually, is about a woman. It's her confession. She's done this very, very terrible thing that I cannot tell you about. But and she's confessing from jail, and her childhood is in Sri Lanka. So the first third of the book is in Sri Lanka, and then the second two thirds are actually in San Francisco, which is where I live. So it's quite close to home.
That is amazing. We could talk for hours, and I have so much more to talk about, but we're out of time. How do we find you on online, and where can people go to find you?
Yeah, so my website is just naomimunavira.com, naomimunavira.com. And then the book is Island of a Thousand Mirrors. It should be at your bookstore or library or on Amazon.
Perfect. Perfect. Naomi, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Great. Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Aline Ohanessian will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. There's no excuse not to tune in. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Aline Ohanessian was born in Kuwait and immigrated to Southern California at the age of 3. After getting her MA in history, she abandoned her PhD studies when she realized her heart belonged to the novel. Where did we hear that before? I think we heard that in the first half hour. Everybody's abandoning their PhDs for the novel. I love it. Her writing was a finalist for the Penn Bellwether Award for Socially Engaged Fiction and the Glimmer Train Best New Writers Award. It's the number one indie pick for April, a Barnes & Noble Discovery pick, an Amazon Best Book of April pick, probably a host of other picks I'm missing. Orhan's Inheritance is her first novel. It's currently being translated into several languages. Aline is an alumni of Breadloaf and Squaw Valley Writers Conferences. She lives and works in San Juan Capistrano with her husband and two young sons. And in the interest of full and fair disclosure, she's my dear friend and fellow workshopper. And I certainly haven't been in this novel from the beginning, but I've been with it for a while. And so I've been looking forward to this day with the two of us together here on air for years. Aline, hi.
Hi.
Hey. So I am going to let you do the novel introductions, take us into Orhan's Inheritance and how it came to be and a little bit about the novel.
Sure. Orhan's Inheritance is a novel that takes place in two time periods. The first is 1990. Orhan is a young Turkish businessman who goes back to his tiny village to bury his grandfather, only to find out that his grandfather has left the family home where many of his aging relatives still live to a complete stranger in Los Angeles named Seda. And so Orhan is sort of dumbfounded, and he hops on a plane and goes to Los Angeles to discover who this person is, why his grandfather would do such a thing. And it's really about him finding about himself, finding things about his family and also his country's history and sort of changing the way he sees the world as a result. And the other part of the book takes place in 1915 in the Ottoman Empire, in the backdrop of the Armenian Genocide. But the central plot of the second part of the book is really a love story between Orhan's grandfather at age 19 and a young Christian girl. Orhan's grandfather is Muslim, of course, and a young Christian girl named Lucy. So all these characters somehow connect by the end, and there are twists and turns, and it all makes sense. But in the beginning, there's a lot of mystery for Orhan, and I think for the reader as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I know this was, you've talked about this being a novel that chose you more than you choosing it, and you set out not to want to write about the Armenian Genocide. So talk a little bit about your relationship with the novel, your need to tell this story, and how the novel sort of came to you.
The novel began when I heard a distinct voice. It was a very old female voice saying something about the futility of words. And I think the quote was like, there's what happened, and then the words come later, polluting everything or inserting everything with meaning. And being someone who loves words and believes in the power of language, this was a strange idea to me that, you know, that words just weren't enough sometimes. And so I started building around that voice. I started building a character around it, but she was very hesitant and didn't want to speak because didn't believe that sharing her story would do any good. So when I got stuck, I started borrowing from the experiences of my great-grandmother, Elizabeth, who was a survivor of the Armenian Genocide and told me about her harrowing experience when I was very, very young, maybe like 8 or 9 years old. And so I started borrowing from my great-grandmother's story and just creating an entire world around this character who refused to speak and share her story with me. And it sort of went from there. It just started building. And, yeah, that's sort of the germ of the novel.
Yeah. How inconvenient to have characters who characters who won't speak, and dealing with them, dealing with difficult, reluctant characters. And, you know, if we follow the advice that we have to inhabit the character and not have the character come through us, you know, they have to be authentic. To be dealing with such a reluctant character must be a huge problem. And to give her a voice through your great-grandmother, I think, is a eloquent solution.
Yeah, you know, what helped with her silence was the character of Orhan, this Turkish man who really needed her story, really wanted to know why his grandfather had left her their home. And that's when the novel came alive for me, when Orhan entered the picture. And Orhan is a decent human being, but just completely politically apathetic and sort of oblivious to history. And the best part was watching a character like his suddenly become more and more aware and less apathetic.
Yeah, right, right. I want to mention that this Friday, April 24th, is the 100th anniversary of their Armenian genocide. And I know a lot of businesses are closing in commemoration of that. There are a lot of marches being staged. Tell me what this Friday looks like for you and for your family.
My family and I, my husband has closed his business. My children won't be going to school. It's the 100th anniversary. It's a very, very long time to be to have this tragedy be acknowledged by the Turkish government. We're walking for 6 miles to the consulate, the Turkish consulate, and staging a peaceful protest. It's the trauma of the experience. It was horrific because we're all descendants of survivors, but the 100 years of denial is difficult to endure, and it just saddens me that we're still waiting for some sort of recognition from that government. I just can't imagine a world where Germany hadn't acknowledged the Holocaust. I can't imagine a world where the United States didn't acknowledge Manzanar, you know?
Right.
It's just hard for me to. It creates this kind of transgenerational grief that has been around way too long. You know, the writing this novel was my way of coping with that transgenerational grief.
Right, right. And I was wondering if there were any, by writing the novel, if there were any new insights into your previous understanding, if what had been learned in your act of writing this, not about the act of writing, but if it changed your understanding of what your great-grandmother went through, what your transformation process was in the act of writing the book.
Yeah, I think writing a book transforms you no matter what the subject matter is, obviously. And sometimes if the book has done its job or is a good book, reading the book transforms you most of the time. But in this particular case, you know, I learned a lot about the sort of the psychology of denial, all the different kinds of denial, and I understood the modern Turkish psyche a little bit better because I was inhabiting not only Orhan's mind, but his grandfather Kemal's in the 1915 love story. But in the end, I definitely came away with the idea that this transgenerational grief, for me, it was like, do I pass it on to my young American-born sons? And the answer is yes, and that's part of the reason why they will be marching with me on Friday. This is their history, and until it's acknowledged, you know, I consider it my duty to inform them and educate them about their past.
Right.
So, I mean, my transformation was just a sort of a reaffirming of you know, this sort of duty to tell this particular story.
Right.
And also to understand the Turkish psyche, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, to take on the other point of view is commendable. We touched on this in the first half hour, and I want to talk to you about it, of English as a second language, and whether it helps you as a writer, because your language, your word choice is very poetic. And I was wondering if you found frustrations in English in its inability to communicate certain emotional tones for this, because I was kind of wondering if America doesn't really have an adequate language for genocide. We've experienced the atrocities of war, but English-speaking Americans, unlike Native Americans, haven't experienced genocide on American soil. And I was wondering if you found any frustrations in writing this in English, and if you thought that your native tongue may better have communicated some of these emotional tones.
I will say that I've been having a love affair with the English language even before I came to the United States. My mom tells stories of when we happened to be living in Kuwait, and every time Jimmy Carter came on the television, on the news program, I would call him my friend and sort of chatter away at the image on the screen. And I've been having a love affair with English for a long, long time. I am bilingual, and Armenian is sort of the language of my soul. I recently had to recite poetry at a commemorative event last night, and I couldn't recite any poems in Armenian because I would just weep. So I think that there is, you know, the language of my soul is my first language, but I don't think the English language is insufficient in any way to tell this story. I think it was wonderful to tell it in the language that I use on a daily basis and the language of my intellect. You know, if Armenian is the language of my soul, and I did, I used a lot of Armenian words and Turkish words, because this is a very, you know, it's set in an exotic setting, in a village in Anatolia. So it's peppered in there, and I think it's just enough to give a reader like me, I consider myself an American reader, an idea of that time, that place, the sense of that culture, just enough. I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah.
I couldn't have written this. I could not have written this novel in Armenian anyway.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Aline Onhanesyan. The book is Orhan's Inheritance. And I know that you're interested in this gap between experience and language and what happens versus the words we use to describe what happened and how it changes the meaning of the experience itself, and sort of how that shapes history. And, you know, you have this character who decided that language was just futile. But for you, it's obviously the opposite. You make your life out of language and the words to describe these experiences. So talk about that sort of intellectual, philosophical gap and closing it, and your thoughts on that. Is that too esoteric of a question?
No, it's a fun thing to ponder, and it is one of the major themes of this book. So, I feel like languages are, there's a great quote by the philosopher Heidegger, and he says, language is the house of being. In its walls, man dwells. And those who create with words, I think he says that they're the guardians of being.
Right.
I'm probably botching up that that quote, but I really can't think of anything outside of language. And, you know, I don't know, it's that idea of like a rose by any other name. You know, it doesn't really matter what we call something. I think of like when a woman calls a sexual violent episode a rape, and how that empowers her when she can identify something for what it is. And I feel like words are such tools. You know, they can empower, they can tear you down. And which words we use really, really matter. You know, you know, calling something a rape as opposed to, you know, a sexual transgression or something like that. There's a big difference. So that gap that you're talking about between experience and the words we use,
it's everything.
It's so unconscious. Like, we don't think about it, right? We don't really think about what we call things. And so I feel like that there should be more thought into, you know, what words we're using to describe things and people and experiences. I mean, even the characters in the book, few of them have several different names in a lifetime, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I find that really interesting. I feel like how we perceive ourselves in the world are just all constructed by the words we use, the means we call things. I just find that topic extremely interesting.
Which is why this argument over using the term genocide has become so critical in the last 100 years, right? I mean, that they will not use that word is everything, right?
Yeah, well, the thing is that word is a legal term, an international law term, and it has consequences, just like the word rape has consequences, or, you know, a war criminal. You know, war criminal is very different than, you know, a very bad man or something.
Right.
You know, I feel like the hesitation on the part of the Turkish government is because certain words have consequences. Sometimes they're legal consequences. Sometimes they're moral, social consequences. But so the words really do matter. Which ones we use matter, and I think that's why there's so much contention over, you know, what word we use to describe this historical event.
Right, right. And I guess the twin sister of this conversation about language versus experience is memory, individual memory, national memory, transgenerational memory, and, you know, how the memories are passed through the generations. And I was wondering what was learned of memory during this process. I mean, it might be impossible to accurately answer, but I wonder if the act of writing the novel changed your memories of your childhood experience with your grandmother and great-grandmother and what she told you, and if the novel has become sort of more real than the experience itself, or, you know, is kind of supplanting memories. And I mean, of course, you can't answer that because you're inside of it, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on this sort of experience of memory and writing history.
Yeah, you know, memory is such a slippery thing. You can be have two people in the same family and go experience the same exact event and have a completely different memory of it. So when you apply that sort of slipperiness, for lack of a better term, like on a national level, you can imagine the sort of variances and nuances that result from it. But I feel like you can contest the sort of details of a specific thing, but not its entire existence, you know?
Right.
And, you know, the way that, you know, writing this novel affected the way I see memory is I can't read a novel now without seeing the theme of memory in it. I feel like all novels are on some level about memory. It's such a huge part. It's such a pillar of identity, you know, that... And identity is such a, you know, central part of, like, the human experience. So I feel like all novels everywhere are on some level about memory and identity.
Yeah. Yeah. My guest this morning is Aline Ohanessian. The book is Orhan's Inheritance. And the other big theme in this that I think is worth bringing up is art and the expression of art. Orhan, excuse me, is a photographer. Kamal has his sketchbooks. The tapestries and rugs themselves are art. And I was thinking of art as another form of language, a way of telling a story in sort of a different medium. And I was wondering if you'd just talk about your thoughts on this, the importance of visual art in the book and kind of storytelling outside of language.
Yeah, you know, when I was having conversations with friends and other writers about some of the themes of this book, I kept saying, like, there's nothing outside of language, you know, like, there's just nothing. I can't think of a single thing. And people brought up sex or, you know, birth, and And then I started thinking about the sort of extensions of language and other ways of storytelling. And I do have a visual arts background. I was a fine arts major going into undergraduate school. And so, you know, I wanted to kind of explore what's the gap between experience and visual language and the arts. And I think there's a much broader gap there. There's way more room for, I don't know, if you want to call it interpretation and, you know, the mysticism of understanding what it is to be human. And I think that's also the appeal of the visual arts.
Right, right.
I just felt like if that was maybe one of the major themes of the book, then I would have to explore other forms of storytelling.
Right, right. We're drawing down on our time, but I also wanted to touch on writing atrocity. Talked a little bit about this in the first half hour, too. And I know you struggled with this question of how much atrocity to include, how many details, what becomes important to relay and what becomes gratuitous. And we had many conversations about that in the editing of the book. And I was talking, wondering if you could talk about that balance and how you resolved it, how you came to think about it. I know you left a lot of things out, but you really struck, I think, the right balance in conveying the right amount of information to, you know, one thing came to stand for a lot of things, so the reader really got the picture without kind of being pounded over the head with it.
Yeah, that was really important to me because, you know, like all writers, I'm a voracious reader. And as a reader, I don't like to be pounded over the head with atrocity after atrocity. I'd rather develop a deep connection with a character or you know, a secondary character, and then have, you know, strong emotions when they are met with, you know, when they experience difficult or horrific things. I didn't want to be gratuitous in any way. I also felt like that would be just a, I don't want to say like a cheap way of garnering the reader's emotional, you know, response, but I just felt like it was too easy, and I wanted to have as much respect for my reader as I possibly could, but still be true to how difficult and horrific this particular period in history was. So I was very attuned to that balance that you're talking about, and I tried my best not to, you know, not to overwhelm the reader with too much darkness.
Right. Right.
There's some humor in the book, which I think is very necessary, and, you know, and other elements like the love story that make it uplifting.
Right, right. We could talk for hours. Well, we have talked for hours, but we could keep talking today for hours. Any last-minute words of advice, having come through a very, as all debut novelists tell me, it takes years to do this. What was learned through the process, and what advice you give now that you've been through it?
I think the best piece of advice I have to give other writers is to your subject wisely. Have it be something you are infatuated with, because it's kind of like a mini marriage, you know. It's like a, you know, 5 to 10 year relationship with characters and place and setting, and you really have to be like burning to tell this story. And I think that sustains you through and gives you the sort of resilience you need, because you need a lot of resilience to push this all the way to the end, because it's a long process. You know, between the point when you begin the book and the point when it's in a capable editor's hands at a publishing house, you need that faith, that burning need to tell the story to pull you through.
Right, right. So tell us all the places we can find you online and elsewhere.
Well, I have a website, alinohanessian.com, but you can buy the book at your favorite indie store, Barnes & Noble or Amazon, Audible, iBooks. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. I know. And all of your Southern California tour, are you done in Southern California?
I have my events listed on my website, and I update that weekly. So I'm actually great with book clubs. I'm available, but I am doing a book tour right now, and I think I'll be on the East Coast for a few weeks in May.
Fantastic, fantastic. Aline Ohanessian, thank you so much for taking the time this morning. This was great.
Thank you for having me.
That was Aline Ohanessian. The book is Orhan's Inheritance. As she says, it is out and available now. It is everywhere and it's getting great press. That's all the time we have for this morning. I want to give a little plug to our other public programming here on KUCI. If you tune in regularly to Writers on Writing, which I hope you do, I would encourage you to check out a number of other wonderful music shows and public affairs shows on this station. We have other great news shows on here. We have food shows. We have Ask a Leader shows. We have film shows on film. There's kind of no end of it. And you can go onto KUCI's website, kuci.org, to check out a programming guide. But there's a wealth of great programming on this station. And we are going to be celebrating that in the next couple of weeks in our fund drive. So be sure to tune in next week. I will be right back here with you next week with two more fantastic authors. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Stay tuned for a little bit of reggae with Sister Rue coming up next. And I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. So stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening.